Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening, subscribing, sharing, liking, giving 5-star reviews, all that stuff that you're doing to get the word out and bring more visibility to National Coast Guard Museum and this podcast. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, everybody. And if it's your first time here, welcome. We're glad you found us. After you listen to this episode and love what you hear, go back and listen to some of our other episodes. Subscribe to us. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. We're everywhere that you can imagine. And tell us what you'd like to see. Give us a 5-star review. And let's keep this thing going.
Hey, let's welcome Bill back from his hiatus.
My COVID quarantine. Yeah,
due to COVID-19. luckily, he is healthy and safe and back with us, same with his family.
And so appropriately socially distanced and wearing a mask.
And wearing a mask, good. Yeah. So I didn't wear one because apparently masks are only to protect others from yourself. And I'm fine.
I feel protected.
All right. As long as you do, man. Hey, we've got an awesome one for you today. So not only is he a Coast Guard veteran, but also a 30-plus year veteran of the fire service. So you know we got a good one.
We don't know where this is going to go, but it's going to go somewhere cool.
Yeah, it's going to go somewhere fun. So who we've got on the line, Mr. Dara O'Malley, born in Norwood, Mass., joined the Coast Guard back in 1975 with recruit company Romeo 9-4 or 9-4. Went from there from recruit training to Station Chatham, then to Station Humboldt, became surfman number 111. I've seen the check. Went back to Station Chatham after his time in Humboldt. Started out as an XBO in the Point Turner and decided that he wanted to kind of homestead where he was at back in Connecticut. Got out, went to work with the post office, and then with the fire department there in Norwood. And with that, welcome to the show, Dara.
Good afternoon, guys. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, man, on this. I know you're probably quarantined like the rest of us, right?
Yeah, I'm grounded for a little bit. Yep.
Fair enough. Well, hey, we're glad that you're staying healthy, and we're glad that you're with us.
Absolutely.
Same to you, guys.
Hey, so we got a whole audience out there that are also quarantined and totally not entertained and just probably sad and dejected. So this is your job, Dara.
You're going to entertain us today.
Yeah, let's get these people amped for living.
Good enough.
All right, I'm gonna let Bill ask the question.
With that hard to live up to intro, Darryl, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, I got a couple of good ones that I'd like to tell you, but I think I'll keep it short and just go over where I was in 1975, and that was at U.S. Coast Guard Station Chatham. And one little ditty I wanted to give you guys was I remember being on watch And, you know, you weren't supposed to read on watch during those days. And they were live watches. You had to listen to the radio. But you also had details to do, you know, scrub the toilets or, you know, put the watch to the group. And then you could go off and do stuff. And a lot of times I'd catch up on my cleaning that they left me the list. And I saw this book called Shipwrecks of Cape Cod. And I started thumbing through it. And, of course, Bernie Weber, the rescue of Bernie Weber's Pendleton Rescue, used to always, I just found it interesting. I used to look at that book and try not to get caught on watch. If it was the mid, everybody was down anyways. But I used to read about it and think about it and dream about it, you know, dream about those heroic rescues. And not that I wanted to be involved in it, but I also felt like, I wonder how long it takes to get that good at something, you know, becoming a coxswain or running a boat. So I was new to it, but I just wanted to make that point that it stuck with me all these years. And it ended up that's what I wanted to do when I started doing more training at Chatham Coast Guard. We had a different station altogether than a lot of them on the East Coast, but, you know, with shoals and a changing bar and also, we had the pride of Bernie Weber. So I guess that's what caught my attention. And so I just wanted to throw that in to just let you know that I did have him in my mind the whole time as I slowly became a SA, SN, SN coxswain, non-rate. I made non-rate coxswain in Chatham. And I started listening and I started learning and I started watching the older guys teach me, give me that time to how to throttle and how to steer and how to do fog nav and how to get that radar that never worked to work. But I just wanted to give a shout out to those guys. And I know if you're listening and some of you that are still around and some of you that have gone and crossed the bar, I really know that you changed my course in life to where I ended up. And it's probably going to be ending up with that rescue that I'll be talking about. But I just wanted to give a shout out. I don't forget you. I appreciate it. And to any younger guy that's listening, listen, give those older guys, whether they're MKs, TTs, whatever they are, give them a little bit of respect and listen to what they got to say. Then go and think about what they had to say and put it into your hands and your mind. And that's the way it's done. The policy, the way the book teaches you, and train on that. And it won't do you wrong. It didn't do me wrong, is I guess my long-winded part of it is I got taught by a lot of good people, and I'll never forget them for it. And I thank you. I throw it out there to them that I thank them very much for catching me at a good time when I was young and fearless. And yeah, that's how it ended up. So
solid, Dara. Yeah, I like it. I like what did you watch the movie?
Oh, I eventually did. Yes, I went by myself, believe it or not. I wanted to see this all for myself. I knew it was coming
right,
because I was from Chatham, and I was not involved in it. But, you know, I was keeping tabs, and I was so glad that Bernie and their gang, I can't think of the names right off the bat, but I will. It'll come back to me. But I did go to see it, and why do you ask, Bill? I'm sure you saw it, right?
Yeah, I'm just curious, yeah. Like, what was better, the book or the movie? The CGI or the book?
I thought the movie did it justice. You know, a lot of people had doubt in, you know, the way a 36-footer flies through the air. But I pictured that was the only way that director could really put into a film what Bernie was telling him and his crew was telling him, because that's really how it was. Enormous seas, impossibilities. I mean, he did it, so I thought it did it justice, you know. I did. I thought it did it justice, and I to this day, you know, anybody that questions it, no, that man and that crew did above and beyond what they were asked to do, and they got back safe, and that was the key to it all. So I'm very proud to have known someone from Chatham, or that Bernie Weber and his crew, and I also knew him to be a humble man. And I may not sound like it now by talking the way I am, but I was humble back in the day, too. I took everything that I could get to teach me to be a better person in life and be a better coxswain and all that stuff. So I know that about Bernie Weber. When he went to get his medal, he refused, and I love it. He refused. He dug in and said, my crew. And then maybe I'll take it. And they backed down off him. You know, he was that kind of a man that, you know, they weren't going to get him to go to different areas and make a big to-do about Bernie. he wanted it about his crew, and I loved that. I thought that was the most important part of the whole movie, that he showed that his crew was more important than anybody else, and he couldn't have done it without them. So,
for sure, awesome. And I agree with you. Yeah, and I like the little bosun mate antics that they put in there too, like the radio thing. I've seen that happen.
It's not working.
Yeah, the radio's broke. I can't hear you. And then yeah. It's gone. Or when you come in and it's been a long day and you're a long sortie and you're coming back and then you see the lights on shore. I know, like, not as dramatic as all the headlights from the cars, certainly. But like whether it's the lighthouse or the lights from the city, the lights from the town, whatever, like you see that and it's that same feeling, you know, yeah. Like, oh man, I made it.
Well, just like, that, yes. Like that second you get in, and I'm not a surfman, not a heavy weather guy, but crappy weather's crappy weather.
The ocean's the ocean, right? Bro. Yeah.
That second you like come around and you get in the harbor and everything lays down, the energy just drains out of you. Like, yep. I love that scene in the end of the movie where he's just like laying against the wheel.
Yeah.
Because we've all felt that, like, oh, yeah, some version sure. of that, where like I'm done now.
Yeah. It's over. I'm going ashore.
5 minutes ago, I was cool and I was driving this boat, and now I'm done.
Yep.
Like, absolutely, you got it all there, Bill. That's exactly how I took it too. And that there's a couple of photos of him in the same thing. And when you do systematically go through what he went through, that's his exact feeling. He's going, oh, I am glad this is over. You know, this is, yeah. And I got to tell you something. I did talk to him prior to his death. We were talking, and I forget why. Oh, my daughter wrote a story. Years later, my daughter wrote a story about him, probably from hearing me talk so much of Mr. Bernie Weber. And I want everybody to know I don't hold any comparison to that man, except I wanted to be like him. You know, I looked so up to him and his crew that I just wanted to be like him. And I'm not saying that I was, but it was the path I followed. And so regardless, the school contacted him to come up, and he called me personally and said, no, I'm not going to be able to make it. Mary's not feeling well or whatever. So we were shooting the breeze, and it was like an honor to talk to him. But at the end, I asked him, and you might see quirks about what he said, but I said, Bernie, even after all we've talked about, I said, how did you do it? And he said, Dara, do you believe in divine intervention? And I said, I absolutely do, which I want you to know I do. Miracles. But I said, I do, Bernie. He says, well, that's divine intervention. That's the answer he gave me. And it, you know what? How else could he have done it without another assist from the supreme being? You know what I mean? Our God, to help him get through that. And that's how I just wanted to relate that to you, that I believe in God. And I just believe that, yeah, sometimes he does at your end's rope, at your 11th hour. He'll send help if you pray hard enough. And I'm sure Bernie was praying hard that night. But
that's
that
what I was going to say, man. Yeah. I don't, whether you believe or not, right? It's sometimes, I think most people pray.
There's no
at some
atheists
point.
In foxholes.
It's true, man. Same thing happens at sea.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's
so
good.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good stuff.
Definitely. Very cool. Well, Dara, let's hear the story.
Yeah.
So from there, you know, I kind of learned the ropes, and, we were back in post-Nam. And, throwing that radio, yeah, that was like a to-do, you know. That was like, yeah, the brass used to always be a pain in the ass when, you know, our fishing boats ran aground. They make a big to-do about nothing, blah, blah, blah. And so a lot of times I was taught, yeah, don't listen to the radio. You listen to, you're on scene, you're doing your thing, you'll get the pertinent information to them. So that kind of pirate hooliganness, you know, screw them, we're going to do our own thing, and, you know, they're not here, and, you know, that's where that feeling came. So it carried on through me, and I got and I raised some hell, but I was pretty squared away when I came to duty. You know, I just knew that it was a gift to come to duty, and I was going to learn as much as I could. So I could go over some of the other antics that we've talked about after you can talk about the Coast Guard. But I had a good group of guys too, though. And even though we fought tooth and nail, snipes versus bosun mates and TTs and ETs, we were like a family there. And so I got transferred to Humboldt Bay, and I, boom, wow, what a big difference, because it wasn't that camaraderie yet, and it wasn't that family setting yet. This was a huge station. It was a group at one time. They had leftover injured people. It almost was like a melting pot of the 12th District, to where if you had nowhere to put anybody, put him at Humboldt Bay. Now, that was my take of it. And eventually, you know, process moved people out that weren't doing their job or couldn't do their job. So we started getting more deck people in and more engineers in. And it slowly became a surf station that it was supposed to be. It was run by the captain of the port at one time and then a commander from the group, and the group moved to the air station. So it was night and day from Chatham. We were Chatham, you're in the middle of a town, people loved you. Fishermen, you always were trying to get along with, but Humboldt Bay was out in the spit of land. And the other thing I noticed was, you know, night and day was that their boats, like, you know, their boats was not even comparison at Humboldt Bay to the East Coast, because we took care of our boats. You know what I mean? We were constantly maintaining our boats and being ready. And because we knew the weather, we knew the Northeast storms, we knew the fog, we knew the summer winds picking up and stuff like that. But I was amazed that really the maintenance issue on these boats were terrible, guys. It was really disheartening for a boatswain mate to walk on board and see these things bent, banged up, and it was terrible. But we eventually.
Do you feel it? Do you feel the animosity, Bill? Hey, East Coast versus West.
I'm an East Coast guy, so I'm just sitting here with my mouth shut.
Well, I don't know why, but I guess I could go into too that, you know, then I started understanding a little bit of the lingo and the 13th and Oregon and 52s and, you know, McAdams, and like, you never seen this guy, could never run a boat like anybody else I ever seen before in my life. And I'm sitting there with my, you know, Boston Tri, little punk, going for surfmen. And I kept saying to myself, oh yeah, we'll see, we'll see. Well, come to find out, then there was not animosity, but there was competition, because I was from the East Coast and I talked the way I did. I wasn't going to turn out to be much, and you guys think you're great, but listen, we surfmen really are the greatest in the 13th. And so I took it for a long time, but I had to put my foot down. So I started a little war saying, oh yeah, who's that McAdams guy? And I hope you're not listening, Chief McAdams, because
he'd be like, it's Master Chief.
Master Chief, but I didn't like you, and I didn't like any guy, person from the 13th that was at Humboldt Bay bragging. Now you're in the 12th, man. You're at Humboldt Bay. We'll make this place good. So it became a healthy competition, and I didn't back down from the arguments, but I knew that someday, you know, that we would train and we would get better, and it was like an operational thing. We would get up and run, and then we did. We became one of the silent top stations of the 12th District, and I'm proud of that because of the guys I worked with. And by the way, there was a guy named Thad Barrier, Royce Heckendorn, Paul Sweeney, Eric Foster. Those was the nucleus. There were, you know, all boatswain mates, of course, but we teamed up and we just knew that we had to get better at what we were doing because we were in such a dangerous spot. So now I'm going long-winded as far as when I went out there, but I got lucky that I eventually was supported by my chief and XO, that training was top maintenance. And my thing was, you know, there's every reason why a boat that can't look good, but there's no reason why it can't be clean and organized. So I just stuck with that, got into operations, and, you know, started spending money on survival gear. Like, we had life jackets that you wouldn't accept on a pleasure craft, you know. And so we eventually built and built and built, and we had a good nucleus of people, and we understood how dangerous the bar was. So I guess that segues into training, and we trained and trained and trained, and a lot of times I'd make them mad because if they made me bad, we'd train after work. You know, they thought, you know, we'll train during the day. Uh-uh. You know, we're going to go out at night when it's the real deal. Like, a lot of times you see these pictures of boats in the surf, but my take on it was, with my other boatswain mates, was that ain't real. At least you can see. What about when you can't see, you know, when it's pitch black? And to this day, I'm glad we chose that, to go out there at night, transit the bar, maybe dusk patrols when the fleet was coming in. You know, we got a feel for what it's like when the sun's not shining, you know. And I thought that was important in as far as being prepared and getting the crews prepared, that it wasn't always going to be the perfect setting like we would want it to be, you know.
So did you guys go out at night? You guys went out and trained at night in the surf zone?
Well, not so much in the surf now, okay, because we knew how dangerous it was, but we would go out at dusk and we would transit the bar. Yeah, we were kind of made rules up as far as, yeah, you're not doing surf drills at night, not unless you got the other boat out there And we had a 36-footer at the time that we used to always try to keep up. And, you know, all boats were out there at night. So we did do night training, Phil and Bill, but it wasn't like the day training in the surf. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you had it.
But area familiarization, you know, you think this is fun? Let's go out at night and try it. And then it's completely different, right? I mean, lights and jetties and horns and stuff. But I just give credit to the training that I was involved in and that we were pushed to do, because at the end it came out to really be helpful. And
that's what I always hear from bosun mate A school students, is that during the day, right, like they go out, they train, it's all fine and good, and then all of a sudden when the lights go off, if they've never seen it before,
it's amazing. Like,
that was insane. I didn't know it was like that out here. Every time, without fail.
Which is super cool, because then they'll carry that with them maybe to the next unit, and they'll get underway when they get qualified. Hey, it's no good sitting here behind the desk or watching TV playing Nintendo. Get out there at night. You know, you're good enough to be qualified. Now get out there and get your crew qualified and start looking. And
when the Bernie Weber cases happen, damn it. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Bernie Weber ain't responding during the day. Come on. He's in the fog at night.
He was such an unbelievable man. And the chief, too, was such a typical Coast Guard chief. You know what I mean? Take that boat and get out there. Like, you're going out to your death, you know?
Well, they had to go out.
Had to go out.
Yeah. Yes. And so while I'm at it, when I got to the dock at Humble Bay, I knew where I was at that point in my life in the Coast Guard, and I know I was fairly squared away, and I didn't want to be, you know, a bad bosun mate, but I knew I had a lot of squaring away to do, and I knew I had the support there. But one thing I noticed, and I did say out loud, on the dock out there, it said, ye all have to go out, but ye all don't have to return. And it was kind of the first time I ever saw it, and I said to myself, I don't like that. You know, I'd rather have it say, ye can return, or ye have to return, but I don't like that part about you all go out, but ye all don't have to return. So it was kind of a little, I'd say to myself, why, you know, but it was salty, and it was from the surfing of the day, and that's their motto, of course, but I just didn't like it. It didn't sit well with me, you know, because I wanted everybody to come back. I want to go out and do your job, and we expect you back, but that's just a little pet peeve of mine. I became a surfman, and I believe it, but, you know, it's kind of a hard thing to sell to the younger generation. You all have to go out, but you all don't have to return. You know, that's kind of a hard thing to sell when you're in a danger situation. You know, you should be thinking positive the whole time and survival the whole time and training, and we'll get through this. But I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Even back in the day, I think the reality of it, right, even though that was the motto, the reality was I think you had to attempt to launch twice, and if it didn't work out, then you could revisit and come up with something else.
Sure.
So even then there was a little bit of, maybe not risk management, but at least like, hey, we get it. It's not, maybe it's not going to happen every time. Right. Maybe we got to figure something else out.
Well, and I think what I'm hearing you say is you don't want that you don't have to come back part to be a crutch to not do it right.
Yeah. To do something.
Right. And if you do it right and you train right, like all the stuff we've talked about so far, the odds of you coming back is exponentially higher.
Well put, Chief. Well put. Yes. And I always tuck my rear end in, like when that last say, like that last wave coming across, when you've made it across safe and sound, you know, and it would be a proud thing and a momentous that we did make it back. So yeah, you're right. So maybe I took a little bit too deep, huh, when I got out there first and saw that. but that's who I was made. That's who I became. And the other thing is, not to complain, but those guys in those days, the BM1s and the BM2s and the Serpents, they had kind of an attitude of, you know, they could beat the crap out of our assets and not worry about it once they got back to the dock. And they'd leave the boat looking like hell. And I didn't like that either. So maybe that segued into, you know what, we're going to change things a little bit. You do damage to that boat, you're taking care of it when we get back, or when you after you eat and whatever, but everybody takes care of their own mess. So that was one of the things that I think the East Coast changed with the West Coast attitude is, we ain't cleaning up your mess. You puke, you clean it up. You know what I mean? It's not the seaman's job to clean up after you. So I think I didn't make a lot of friends with some of the bosun mates that I first met out there that were from the 13th and from the 12th, but That was kind of their attitude, and I thought that was another thing that should change, and it did eventually. You know,
yeah, I think some of that stuck, man, because I remember, like, even on the 47, if a surfman had jacked up the rub rail of the boat, because the rub rails are they're a nightmare to get back on. I mean, there's all kinds of like bolting that goes down on this thing, so you would, that'd be the first thing. You get back, you screwed up the rub rail. Guess who gets to go out there and help fix it? I mean, he couldn't do it solo, but at least you had to assist. Right. But the benefit was you got a piece of the rub rail took with you.
Right.
You know, at least at the end.
Yeah. And it was your responsibility because, and you were almost embarrassed. And that's why you became even better at what you did, because you didn't want to be going down the dock watching everybody looking at you painting the stanchions or whatever. So,
right.
So we kind of changed. I think the East Coast, I thought the East Coast changed, some of the attitude out there. But it was all good. Bill, and Bill, nothing bad. It's just little quirks that creep up in my memory, and I think about it, and I say, yeah, well, you know what? We still did good. So, I'd like to mention that we had the 36542, and, here it is. Okay, I'm thinking about this. So, another thing the East Coast Bosun Mates did was we had a district inspection, and they came up, and now the 36542 was our at times our B1 boat, and at times when the other two 44s were so beat up, would be our B0 boat, believe it or not. And the district inspection team, but once we got everything running and we started spending, got money from the district and we started pouring it into the engines and the maintenance of the vessels and stuff like that, the 36 kind of took a back seat. But we still used it, right? So all of a sudden, this young whippersnapper, JG or something, he's coming on the district inspection team, and he's walking around, and he's got the white glove, and he's doing this, that, and the other thing, and he gets us underway. Now, I'm pretty confident at that point we were well-trained. We had trained and trained and trained and trained. That's like a year or two later that I was there. And the guys like Paul Sweeney, Thad Barry, and Roy Secondon, those guys, super squared away. And so... But when we got back for the critique, he decides to say something nasty about the 36-footer, right? And which days before we had a call, a case. We were real close to those dolos out there on the bar. And we managed to get the Point Winslow across and a couple of 44s as escorts. They were towing boats. So the boat was actually working, and if she was fine, she just wasn't a 44. But he mentioned something about being unsafe, and he kind of said it the wrong way, like it was almost like,
oh, I can't wait.
Yeah,
oh,
this is gonna be good.
So I had the most mellowest Chief Thad Barry, who was very righteous and very Christian. But the next thing I know, I'm coming across the rec deck at him, and I'm saying, what are you talking about? We were just underway a couple of days ago, escort the Point Winslow. You talk to the Point Winslow and tell them that's not a safe boat. So the guy, the JG backs off, and the barrier grabs me, says, okay, O'Malley, all right, calm down. I go, no, Chief, that's our boats. They got to understand, if they give us some more money, maybe we can get another boat, a better boat, or we could put some more maintenance into it. But don't declare that in front of the crew that it's unsafe. So I may have had an anger issue, and I may have been taking it wrong, but he said the wrong thing at the wrong time in front of our crew. And I went after him, and none the worse for wear. I didn't go to jail. They didn't bust me, so.
No green tablecloths in your future.
Anytime there's a chance to put a JG in their place, it's well done.
And I know it sounds like I'm bragging, but it did bring our crew a lot. Everybody kind of, go get him, O'Malley, go get him.
Yeah, right. Do what you got to do.
Yeah. So
that's good.
That's my spiel.
Talk to us about the 36 for a minute, because you're, I think, one of like two that we've ever had on the show.
Yeah, we haven't had many.
Yeah, what's your impression of the 36? What's she built like? Minimum crew, all that stuff.
She was a tough boat, let me tell you, to handle. Single screw, always swinging to the left, back and down, tough to dock, but she was solid. And I was very fortunate. I was psyched, but of course, my love was for the 44. I mean, I married those things. I just loved them, from the all the ones that I was on. But I also respected that 36 foot, and I realized that when she had a job to do, and she did, Phil and Bill, I escorted, and I know others have too. And I don't mean to brag and say I, but I escorted the Point Winslow across in probably 8 to 12. And she rode good. She was heavy. Not much could kick her around. But in those big seas, that was a little engine, man. And you saw, you know, you're climbing them, but she was double-ended, and she really performed. She really performed. I would have rather been in a 44-footer. Don't ask me why, but I still have the same respect for that 36-footer. And to this day, I can't imagine Bernie being out there in anything other than a 44. But he did it in the 36, and all those guys before us did that, you know. So I respected the boat, but I guess I was on the curve of going to the 44, you know, and just depending on that more, because she was a beast, and she did everything you wanted her to do, you know, and get you back home. So
the 36 was wood, right? Wood hull?
Yes, she was.
So how do you – I mean, we're all aluminum, right? I mean, yeah, everything's right. Aluminum these days. So how do you maintain a 36-foot wooden boat that's, I mean, what, probably got two decades on it by the time you got there?
Absolutely. And we were scared that if we hauled her out that she would dry out if we couldn't get her back. And we had ways, too, at Humboldt Bay that, you know, the 36 used to ride the rails down and get underway. So our thought was, you know, she's still floating, and we would do a visual for the ribs and on the interior. You could, you know, check out your ribs and making sure that the caulking was there. But as far as maintenance go, yeah, it was regular sand and, you know, paint for deck maintenance. Engine-wise, it was a small enough engine to cramp quarters, but the guys didn't seem to mind, and they kind of took her under their wing. You know, they knew she was history, and as far as that goes, no more electronics than the 44. But, you know, we took care of the radio and the forward – I forget what they called that now, where that person used to go, the forward...
turtle or something? Is it a turtle?
The poor guy was in a lookout. Now, listen, if he had to get back... Oh,
that looks like that little cylinder you stood in, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm sorry, you're kind of drifting because I'm going back.
No, you're good. It's good.
No,
good.
But we did. We was a lot of pride, Phil. A lot of pride was taking care of her, and nothing was ever so major that our engineers or the bosun mates couldn't take care of, you know. So that's how we took care of it. It was just a lot of pride, but we knew we had the 44s, and we kind of so we split the crews up. We would say who wants to, or I would assign, you know, and have a bosun mate in charge of the 36-footer, and that's what he did. And if we had to pull him away to get back on the 44s, we did, but we already had a crew working the 44s, so we split it up. We split the three boats up between the sections and the crews, and we took care of her. We really did. And she was a good boat. And the history on that boat is, it's awful, and I think that's why I got mad, too. I knew the history prior to them coming and saying that about her, but she was underway from Point Reyes back in
that is an old boat if it was an operational Point Reyes, huh?
And didn't she get underway one morning with three wonderful souls, coasties, and they went on a routine fishing call? Maybe they got up real early, maybe it was like 2 or 3 in the morning, right? So they get an operations check, we're fine. They towed the boat and they told the station, yeah, Point Reyes, we're coming back, because she was down at Point Reyes at the time. And all of a sudden Point Reyes is waiting and doing a comm check, and nothing heard, and you're praying and you're hoping, and they sent out a search party, and sure enough, they found her up on the beach. All three souls were lost. So we had a little nickname out
of
respect for her.
I've read that story before. Yeah.
Have you? All right, Phil. So, yeah. And check it out. It's a 36542, and we used to call it like the ghost boat, but we had no fear. You know, we figured we lost three coasties and lives on it, and so we respected her. But I think that's what kept driving us to keep her going, you know, until they called her for her to, you know, go away and or come to a museum or whatever. But I know I leaned on her as an OD, SDO, and surfman. I leaned on her that when we did – our other boats were broke down, we had to use her. So, yeah.
It's a good way
so
to put it. You leaned on her. That's how, yeah. I think it's what we do to boats. Yeah, yeah, it's very good.
Absolutely. Trust them, and yeah, so.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Hey, one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, doing art by and for some daring fighters of the sea with their Coast Guard and maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda.
Check them out on Instagram, Facebook, Etsy, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
Yep.
All right, so, Dara, what's the story? Let's hear it.
All right, here we go.
Here we go.
Dark and stormy night. And you help me out, guys, if I go too far with this. But I remember the day that the last few days at work, there was a hell of a storm coming up the Pacific coast, heading up to Alaska. And the bar, the seas, everything out there, anything you look, I mean, it was smoking. It was like so mad. And this is just my idea of my ocean and how I handled describing it. But she was mad and angered. And I used to sit there and go, oh, please, not tonight. Maybe tomorrow when she calms down a little bit, but not tonight. But we had other factors at that station that would wish this stuff upon themselves. Oh, I hope we get something tonight. And I wasn't fearful of it, guys. But I just said, you know what? I believe in karma. Don't wish stuff like that on yourself until it comes.
Careful what you wish for. You might
healthy
get
healthy respect.
It.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Which kind of declare, I don't know, you can be judgmental or non-judgmental. But when someone says that, are they really thinking right? You know what I mean?
Right.
You, see, those things are popping at 2025 all the way across. You know, if you're lucky enough to make it, and if you're that that season that you can, more power to you. But guess who was the guy that was going to go? It was me. You know, I was the surfman on call. So, and we switched it. We had two surfmen plus the chief plus the XO. And, of course, they day worked and blah, blah, blah. So for 2 days, I watched the weather. I went to the bar, checked it out, said, you know, like in your own head, I'll go if I have to. But if I don't have to, I hope the fleet's in. I hope everybody's behaving, blah, blah, blah. But in the back of my mind, I'm saying there's always one, right? There's always one.
Yep.
So I got relieved about 4 o'clock, and I headed home, and I swung into a Burger King, and I grabbed this greasy Burger King, and I figured I was off the hook for the night. You know, I'd get home to my apartment or wherever I was living at the time, and I think it was a couple of us were living there. And didn't I get home, and I fired down the whatever it was, the Whopper, and I'm, you know, pounding down the the Pepsi, and the phone rings, and it was the watchstander, and he says, hey, Dara, Mitch is on the bar now, and he wants you to come out and take a look with him. I said, what do you got? He says, we got a 56-foot motor yacht from transiting San Francisco to Juneau, Alaska. And I said, where are they? He said, they're about 10 miles off of Chatham. He says, but they're falling apart. And I go, yeah. So I go, what do they want to do? Are they going to just sit out there and jog? Do they want us to come out and escort? He goes, no, he's determined that he cannot make it out there by himself, so he's coming in. And I said, whoa. I said, did Mitch talk to him? And he said, yeah. And the guy declared that he doesn't care. He has to get in. So, and then we went over, of course, you know, not on the phone. I just said, okay, I'm on my way in. Give me a crew. I said, if you can't send a crew, I go, give me one person anyway so I can get it out of North Bay down to the bar. What we did in those days was when the surge was too bad, we kept the ready boat at the dock. And what we would do with the secondary boat is move it up to North Bay because they used to get its head kicked. The boat would just beat on the lines. And it was dangerous for the crew to go down and even check the boats the way they built our finger pier, which years later they rebuilt. And it's perfect now, but because of the surge, we used to move the boat, make the decision to move the secondary boat up to North Bay. And so that's what I did. I said, Mickey, give me a crew, and I'll be there in 5 minutes, you know. So I went tearing out, and not too happy with it, though, trying to figure out, like, what's going on. So as I got there, this girl, new BM3, she was superstar. She was a super girl trying to become a coxswain, so she came up. And she gave me a quick brief. So what really happened is, I'll just reiterate it again, this 56-foot brand-new yacht was going to Juneau, 3 people on board, wooden, got caught in the storm. Probably shouldn't have left San Fran anyways.
Yeah, didn't even make it that far, right?
What's that?
Didn't even make it that far. Definitely not time to leave.
Right. And then, of course, they had twin engines. One engine was down. The gearbox was low on oil. The lady fractured a wrist or sprained a wrist. His remote steering was gone, so he was up on the bridge, and he had to commute the guy on the radio down below. You know how those trawlers are, or those 56-foot pleasure crafts? They got two steering stations. But everything was falling apart. So I felt bad. I did. I kind of put myself in his shoes, says, yeah, you got no other choice. Either that, or if I can get out there, maybe we'll tow you and we'll just jog together the whole night through the storm. And, you know, it just started getting worse. The minute I got that phone call, everything started acting up, you know. So long story short, Dara, we got the boat underway, and me and Yolanda Delgado, I'll never forget her, because she was a superstar, and she didn't back down, nor did I. We knew what we had to do, and that was to pick up another crew member and start heading out to the bar, because Mitch had already transited the bar, and he was already off the sea buoy, and this Koala 2 had reported 25-foot seas, and his engine, one engine, slow, rolls very easily, blah, blah, blah. So there was a lot of thinking I had to do. We had to do, Bosun Mate Mitch Nedler, that was out there already. But we had made a deal prior to that as surfmen that, no way, you don't do anything without me, and I don't do anything without you. So it was already the call, you know, get Dara in here, get, you know, and if it was me, Mitch would have been there in a heartbeat. So there was no even thinking about it, just knowing that. Each minute that went by, I knew something was up here. This is like, I watched it the last 2 days, and like, this is the real deal, you know? So I didn't get worked up. I kind of got my training and set, and you know, helmets and gear, and I picked up a third party. And then I started rounding the jetty to start heading across. So Mitch wanted, you know, a report on the way out. And I think he gave like a 12 to 15, and I'd round the jetties, and I'm already in 15, so I don't know what he's talking about. And he's from the 13th. He don't know what he's talking about. You know, these are 18, 20, but they weren't breaking, so I was happy. And I just really, Phil and Bill, it just, I knew we were going to get in a fight, and I didn't know if we were going to win it. But I'll tell you what, we were ready with all our training and everything we had. And I'm surfing. I had to go out, and I had to come back. But I was hell-bent that I was going to get them and get back and my crew back safely. So,
and Darryl, on a 44, what does a 15 foot swell like? Is that how far overhead of where you're standing?
So the difference between the east, like a 15 foot sea on the east coast, to me was like it's pounding. A swell on the west coast, 15 foot, is not bad when you can see her, and you ride up over them, and it's tall. And they could turn on you in a heartbeat. But, you know, when they don't, it's a good swell. 15's not bad. You know what I mean?
Well, like on a 47, right? Like when if you're sitting on the open bridge and you see 14 feet, your height of eye. So if you're like eye level with the swell, you're at a 14-foot swell, right? Give or take.
Yes.
So how is it on a 44? Would it be how much further over? Is it like double overhead? Is it eye level?
No. No, I would say maybe above eye level. I think what is the range? 12 feet or something?
12 feet. Head on. Okay. Yeah. So it's still big, still over you. Yep.
Yeah, it is, Phil. Now picture this. This is dark, and you know what she can do. But it's not the easiest. It's not the easiest to tow with the 15-foot swell or a 12-foot swell.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then they start breaking, so it gets a little bit better.
Changes the whole dynamic.
So it wasn't bad, but I just, you could hear it. You could hear the ocean, and I sensed her anger the last 2 days. Listen, guys, she was as mad as she could ever get, and she wanted somebody. And I figured, you know, in that quick thought in my head, how much I respected the ocean, I just knew that I got lucky a lot of times. And I was going to try to get lucky tonight, but just something was in my gut like, oh, this is it. So 12, 15, turn into 18. Of course, when you're clearing the jaws of the jetty, you know, you got to take a couple of dips and dives. And, you know, Mitch is squawking at me to check it out. And I'm watching, you know, I'm trying not to catch green water at night. And I'm looking at my radar, and I'm getting a little bit of back, whatever you call it. And I'm saying, is that a wave? Or, you know, trying to get my training back. But we made it across the bar, but with some deep swells. And I bet you they turned into, you know, 18, 20 foot.
Yeah.
So now we go out there and we got a plan. What we're going to do is, this guy's hell-bent to come in, and he doesn't ride well with way on. He only steerage is his only steerage is good with just throttle ahead, and we were going to plan this. We were going to plan a 44 footer to be in front to direct him into the jetties in between the jaws and get across the bar without towing him and get him into a safe port. The other 44 was going to go ahead and escort. And what we used to do in the day was, and it was kind of crazy because you couldn't hit all the ones, but you had to judge these seas now in pitch black darkness because they were getting big. And if a breaker did come, you would throttle up or you'd anticipate it and you'd slice the wave behind the stern of the, say, the Koala 2, and you'd try to dissipate the power of that wave.
Knock him down, right?
Knocking him down. Okay, that's what Dara's trying to say. Yeah. So in theory, it's all good. And when you're out there, but what happened was this.
What a great plan we had.
It was, and I'm picturing it right now, guys. Sorry, I know I told you I was good crazy, but here it comes. So I'm knocking him down, and Mitch calls me, and he says, how's he going back there? And I couldn't say this is wrong. I couldn't say this is right. All I could say was, hey, Mitch, it's getting sloppy. He's not having too smooth of a ride, and really, guys, he wasn't, nor was I. I was dropping off them 20-footer swells, and he could have been right beside me, but it would take me 6, 8, 10 seconds to come back up again and keep a look at him and then look for the next one. So as we got closer to the bar, I don't know if the wind shifted or if the tide was off or whatever, because we had a great ebb tide, 9-foot I think it was, and it would create some, you know, a lot of breakers on the bar. But at this point, put it this way, all hell broke loose. But before it did, I called out to the group, and I said, Group Humble Bay, whatever boat I was on, 7-8, are you monitoring this case? And as quick as Group Humble Bay, Roger. So I said to myself, no, you're not listening to this, you little shit.
Yeah, and I know they didn't say it in that accent either.
No, but Phil, if you just follow me, I don't want to point blame, but you know what? They were a little comfortable up where they were, and I wasn't too comfortable where I was.
Right.
And I had a rapport, or our station had a rapport with almost every pilot up there. They were ex-nom pilots and tail gunners. And off-duty, when we had softball games and stuff, we got to meet each other. And we respected each other for that one call that we're going to need you. You know what I mean? Not confrontation, but that competition, Airedales versus Boston Mates. When the bell rings, you know, it's all of everybody. And I watched those guys perform well above their level. And I thought by saying we don't need anything at this time, but we're running into slop, that one of them would have grabbed the idea and they would have launched automatic. Right. They would have launched, right?
You'd hope
that
so.
That didn't happen. That didn't happen that night. So there was a delay on the launch. So right after I called for that, we were escorting them, and it just got nasty. It's like... It almost became calipotic. It was almost like it was the coming. Here it comes. And so each wave was critical. And she'd lean over that boat that we were escorting. And I'd chop a couple of waves and try to time it. And, you know, of course, but this one time that I picked the wave that I wanted to break, and it was a good 25. I'm telling you, if I didn't climb that straight up, I'm lying. And I knocked it down. But Mitch calls me and says, hey, you know, what happened back there? Did you roll? I thought he said to me, did you roll? And on the way down the backside of this, I'm saying, how the hell could I roll? I'm upright. Didn't even give it thought that he was talking about the Koala. Mm. And I said negative on the way down this backside of this sea. And I get climbing back up again the other side of it, and I turn around and I see nothing. And I'm going, okay, that's okay, because I can't see anything anyways. All I could see was his lights now and then. And I'm looking and looking, maybe – I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds went by, maybe less than that. I look, and I see debris, and I see the remainder of a breaker. And I just said, he's over, Mitch. So the next thing you know, it's all asses and tea kettles. We were ready, but we're quite ready for that. So now we have a capsized vessel on the Humboldt Bay Bar that was inverted by a 25-foot break and blew into a million pieces, guys. Pitch black, you're working with another 44 that's, you know, he's right beside you. You can even see his whips on one second, and then the next second he's on top of you. and you're wondering, is he going to come down on top of you? So we have to try to maneuver and do good both sides of the boat and try to get these people. And we were screaming bloody murder and calling for helicopters and, you know, waiting. And I'll never forget personally what I saw. I saw the whole boat in front of me and a big, it almost looked like a round circle, and I could see inside their berthing area. This is upside down now. And I saw mattresses and coolers and everything else. And I started inching in, and I was timing the waves so as their boat went up, I would go up, you know, with that wave. And I was going to stick my nose in there, hoping that somebody's standing right there and hop on the bow and come out. But it didn't happen. So we started running over debris and stuff like that. And then I hear Mitch saying, I got one in the water. So I said, okay, I'm going to back around and go on the other side. And at this point, my heart was down in my ankles. Like, I'm saying, how does anybody survive this? And my BM3, Yolanda Delgado, I had to send her up to the bow. I said, yo, we got to find him. You got to be my pointer. And without a second, she went up there. She strapped in. And I was watching her, Phil and Bill, because I had to worry about that debris, that hull coming down on top of me. I had to stay within the debris. I had to worry about if he was below me popping up, and God forbid I would run over him. And she was my only hope to finally point something out that, you know, we were chasing lights, we were chasing mattresses, thinking it might be a body. And out of the clear blue, she says, I hear something. And I swung the spotlight over the one spotlight that was working, and I see this little teeny dot, a head. It was like a forehead. And I'm looking at him going, God, he's dead, because all I could see was his forehead, so I figured his mouth was below the water. Then I lost sight of him. So I start powering over to him, and so one thing led to another. I guess it's going to be an III story, but I just maneuvered enough to be able to get alongside him. Yo pointed him down the side, and we caught a break where we could get him on board. I was yelling at the guy to swim because he was beat. And we were too. And we were getting beat on top of it, right? Nothing was easy. It was just kept knocking us around. And my only hope was that I didn't run him over. The last thing I wanted to do was, you know, get alongside him and then run him over, right? I mean, that's your biggest fear, is to run the poor guy over, catch his legs or whatever. But we maneuvered close enough to where we caught a break, and I remember leaving I left the wheel, and I went down beside Yo, and she was trying to get him in, and my engineer was trying to get him in. So she looked at me like, who's at the, you know, she's pointing up at the, I go, just a second, like it was mayhem, right? But she was wondering, did somebody come on board to drive the boat? But I had powder enough to catch the next one, and I knew they needed a hand. So we all, 1, 2, 3, pulled them on. I said, no, get back in the turtle back. And so they were hustling. I'm rushing up to the wheel, and we get bashed again and beat up again, and they finally get him inside. I don't even know if the guy's dead or alive now, right? So Mitch has got two. I got one. We called the group. We're saying we're going to go in. And in hindsight, I guess that was the only thing we could do, was try to get back in. And so the next battle began. And we eventually made the jaws. And the lights, of course, were out in the jetty, and a couple of us ran on wrong lights, and, you know, they just made it worse for ourselves. But and by that time, nothing was working except with the compass and the spotlight. So we finally got in, but here is the ending of my tale. Swear to God, stack of Bibles in front of me, this is what happened. So I'm not happy, and I'm not sad. I am in pure survival mode, thinking I got Yo and the engineer back aft with the survivor. They're safe, right? They're safe. All I got to do is get in. And it was pitch dark. So I'm steaming as hard as I could, and I'm getting to between the jaws. Mitch is inside, and I've watched him disappear several times. I thought he had rolled a couple of times, but luckily our communication stayed on. And again, God's honest truth, I heard it before I seen it, and I could hear it coming to me, and I'm saying, oh, I mean, it puts the hair standing on my head. I go, nah, she's not going to let me go. And the next thing I know, I'm looking straight down, and I'm pissing through the bullnose, and all I got is a little bit of juice left in my stern, and I just hard left, hard port, outboard screw as hard as I could. I skinned my knuckles, and I just went into a porpoise. And I don't know if you guys know what a porpoise is, but it's the last thing you want to do. But you take the chance. And I took a hard left, and I went 90, and I almost went over. And somehow I popped. I had enough momentum off that wave to pop up the other side and start heading out to sea again.
Man, what a feeling. I can feel it. Man, I can feel it.
It's a life changer, brother. Yeah. Let me tell you. So then I'm bummed because what do I do now? I don't even know if my crew's alive in the turtleback. And so you know what I did? I said, screw it. I turned around, and I just started going for it. And I pushed her as hard as she could, and she was all fouled up with the screws and everything else. But you know what? I was close enough where I got in. And I got inside the bar, and we were in. And I said, thank God, on the radio. I thank God that we were in on the radio because she wanted me, and that was the fight. She wanted to get her last lick in, and if she could have, she would have. But all I had left was – actually, it was just it was training, I guess, but it was just automatic. Like, that's the last thing you can do. That's the last thing you can do is try to porpoise out. I wouldn't advise to do that unless you got no other plan or no other option. And it worked for me, guys. It worked for me. So, all right. So then we get inside the bar. And,
dude, what a story. I'm just thinking about it. Yeah, I could feel it when you were talking about it.
Phil, you know why, Phil? Because honestly, I was looking. Can you imagine? Not me. At least I was at the wheel. Can you imagine Yolanda and the survivor?
Yeah, at least you saw it coming, right? Yeah, like you saw it and you knew what was going on. They're just back there thrown around.
So much rather be the coxswain on that than the guy in the cabin.
Yeah, man, no thanks.
And that's who I felt bad for. I thought I was killing them by, you know, getting that. But, yeah, it was exactly that. I'm not lying. Like I said, a stack of Bible. That's what I remember. And I know it was divine intervention because either that or just automation, whatever you want to give it. But we made it, and it was pretty life-changing, Phil. I won't kid you. You know, I had the nuts to go out and do it, and got my crew safely sound, and I could not have done it without them. But that's my sea story, and I'm sticking with it, and that's what happened. So
that's a good one.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So did everybody survive from the?
So yes, sir. So the last mistake I made was I came in at about, I don't know, I was doing 9 knots to the dock, and I forgot about my wake because she was in such bad. My guy was he was near death. And so was in Mitch's woman. She was near death, but the guy was in better shape than her. So we had requested an ambulance, and you asked, did they make it? Yes. So the ambulance is at the dock. All the crew is there, and they kind of took over as we got slipped into the dock and put the lines on. The chief was near the XO, and we got these people off, and they got them into the hospital. And several days later, they came to visit the station to thank us. And, to thank us, but later on, I think it became like an investigation. What did the Coast Guard do wrong? So, but I treated them. You know, I was happy to see them. And I remember, forget the guy I got. He said, I got to ask you a question. He pulled me outside. Now, listen, I don't tell very many people this because they probably won't understand it. And this is the truth. He says, why were you yelling at me? And I said, I wasn't yelling at you. And I knew I was. He goes, no, why did you say swim, you bastard? And I said to him, I don't really remember saying that, but I know I was going to lose you, and I wanted to give you one more yell, wake you up, and help us out because I couldn't get right beside him. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's why I yelled. And I thought, you know, in the Coast Guard, I'm going to get in trouble because I yelled, swim, you bastard, to the guy. But that's all I had in my lungs was to yell to him, please. And you know what? His eyes lit up. He didn't give up. And he kind of paddled a little bit towards us, and we got him close enough and pulled him on. But that was his one question, was why did I yell at him? And I told him. I said, I just wanted to wake you up and get you over here. I had you that close. I wasn't going to lose you. So I yelled at you. So that was
it. Yeah, man. And how crazy, you know, like, I think that's, you know, you talk about the power of the ocean, how the ocean wants to take people. And so it's mind-blowing to me how quickly we can lose people. Just in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, the boat rolls. They're all lucky. Yeah. I mean, all rights, those people probably should have died, right? In that
absolutely.
Case.
Yeah. Phil and Bill. The guy on the bridge was tossed, and the two inside had to escape through through the vessel because they were down below, and when she broke up, they were part of that breakup. So eventually, the hull, I don't know if they got out through a door or the hull, but it spit her out, and then it takes time to surface, and then it comes, you know. So it all happened within minutes, but that's how they survived. It was just luck that they got spit out of their boat, you know, after being inverted, a 56-foot boat. Come on. And so they were ready, and they had the life jackets on. We had prepped them like you're probably teaching your guys. Hey, no matter what, get your life-saving gear. Make sure it's working good and it's good working. So we had them ready, and that's what we were hoping for, was that they would eventually pop up. That's what I was hoping for anyways, was maybe not right now. And that's why I didn't want to get too close to it, because I didn't want to run them over. I didn't know when they were going to pop up or where they were, you know, amongst the debris. So, boy, I made this all about me.
Hey, just another testament, man, to that whole question that you always ask when you get out there, right? Do you have your life jackets on? Put them on. Right?
Like,
top tier.
Yeah. And how many people on board are even on an aircraft? How many souls on board? You know, that carried over in the fire department, too, because we've had a couple of aircraft incidences where it's just training that kicks in. And, of course, not bragging, but you know, you ready to go, guys? We have a system in place. And yeah, Cap, how many people, how many souls on board? Oh yeah, there's three souls on board. You know, it's important to have that training and have that in your head, so when the shit hits the crap hits the fan, that you know what you're looking for. You know,
yeah. So you're not leaving out poor Darren and his boat crew to sit there and suffer through more waves searching for people that aren't there.
And you know that's how we are.
Oh yeah, you know that's what would happen. We're gonna need to stay out there and complete a search pattern because we're not totally sure how many people are on board that boat.
Exactly, and Phil, you know, as you say that as a chief, you know how hard it is to find that needle in the haystack. Anyways, even when you know, those nights that you spent out there, winter nights, looking for that fishing boat that, God forbid, went down. You know how hard it is. You don't want to take your eyes off that ocean, but you do to focus on the deck and keep your eyes. You know, this is what I remember anyways. If your eyes got lazy, you'd look at the deck or the chalk and focus in on it, and then you'd go back to looking because your eyes are focused on something on the deck instead of the water, and you're giving that person a chance. But I guess my point is, it is so hard to find somebody in the water anyways. Without a life jacket, almost impossible, but at night, it's almost like, yeah, we're the Coast Guard, but we, you know, miracles don't happen all the time with us. So you just wonder how many times we might have missed somebody, or we're off a little bit on our search, or, you know, that's the stuff that used to bother me when I couldn't come back with somebody and my crew, you know, when we'd go over everything that we did right and wrong and felt good about ourselves, because we knew it was a lifelong lesson, you know, you lost somebody, but it wasn't something that you did purposely, you know what I mean? Not that you would, but just, you did all the training that you were supposed to, and you gave it your best shot. You went out. You didn't have to come back, but, you know, this time you came back empty-handed. This particular one, and I know I'm talking too much, we did good. We took out of her grasp, out of that ocean's grasp. She wanted them, and she wanted us, and guess what? We lucked out. You know, we lucked out, so.
No, it's awesome. What a story, Dara. Like, what a story.
I hope so, Phil. I hope I don't my soul like, but and you're the first one for a long time for me to tell it, and I told you I would, and I feel good that I got it off my chest, and I just want anybody that's listening to know this, that we really didn't do anything wrong. They did, maybe by making bad mistake on getting underway, or, you know, they're trying to meet that deadline, but the ocean, that's someone you don't mess with, And we got lucky, and I appreciate you listening to me, guys. And if I sounded like it's all about me, it wasn't. It was my crew and Mitch's crew that really, if we didn't perform like right hand, left hand, and all the training that we had gone through, this would never have worked. It never would have. So it did, and it was good. All good stuff, man. Coast Guard lives. Here we go. Excellent.
Thank you. I appreciate you telling the story, Darren. That was awesome.
Yeah, Darren, we want to have you back on, man. So we hit an hour right now, give or take, and usually that's kind of like, you know, where the audience expects it, right? But I'd love to have you back on.
I know there's more stories.
Yeah, man. I want to hear stories out of Chatham. I want to hear how you got that surfing letter out in Humboldt. You know, what they put you through to get it. But
how angry they were to give the East Coast guy the surfing letter.
So I'll make you that opportunity, right? So like either, or I guess not an opportunity. I'll make that request to you right now. Either we just love to have you back on, man, if you're willing.
And, And I hope and pray that I get to see you guys someday and meet you personally. But thank you so much for that. Of course, I would do anything for you or the Coast Guard because of my background. But thank you so much for listening. And if you don't make me sound too bad, I'd appreciate it. And
no, editing. Seriously, what epic story, man. Tons amazing. Of lessons, and we're very, very stoked that you shared it with us and the audience.
Thank you so much, Phil and Bill. And I respect you guys very much for what you're trying to do to keep our legacy alive and the Coast Guard's name, you know, in vain. And I just really appreciate what you guys do. So we'll stay in contact. And thank you very much for listening. Yeah, I appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks for your service.
Thanks for your service.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Phil. Bye-bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.